and welcome to the OMFIF podcast, a weekly discussion on key trends in investment and economic policy from some of the world's leading commentators. Urbanization is a phenomenon that will undoubtedly influence human civilization in the 21st century. By 2030, an estimated 60% of the global population will be living in cities. By 2050, this figure will rise to nearly 70%. In the face of such demographic shifts, there's an urgent need for innovative policies and technologies that can make our cities more safe, efficient, connected, and ultimately more livable and sustainable. In today's podcast, we'll be talking about the concept of smart cities and how these initiatives are revolutionizing the way we live, work, and play to help improve our urban existences. What kinds of use cases exist to optimize, enhance our experiences with the built environment and infrastructure? Moreover, what challenges exist in planning and financing the development of smart cities, as well as managing the data generated from smart city ecosystems? This is Brandon Chai from Singapore, and joining us today is Paul Kent, Global Infrastructure Head of Smart Cities at KPMG, as well as Paul Lam, Strategy and Policy Officer in Digital and Technology from the Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank. Thanks both of you for joining us today and welcome. So perhaps to begin with, let's start off with a short overview of the smart city paradigm. I'd like to turn to Paul Kent from KPMG for this. So Paul, could you give us a background of when and how smart cities actually became a viable concept to aspire towards? Infrastructure and the built environment, these are historically very synonymous with urbanization, but what sort of emerging technologies right now are transforming and offering unprecedented ways for us to develop, interact, and maintain the urban environment?
So in terms of when smart cities started to become more of a viable concept to aspire towards, I think it's really strongly related to the rise of technology. What we've seen in the recent years is just the exponential growth in technology capabilities, the computing power that's available, the ability then to capture data using sensors and other IoT type mechanisms, to store it in various places such as cloud, and then also to analyze the data, both in terms of computing software, quantum computing and other areas, but also in the cloud itself. I think another place that really helped was that the rise of technology became an enabler to make existing processes far more efficient. So rather than more manual ways of doing things with many different touch points and takes a lot of time, a lot of different processes, a lot of different stakeholders, this now can be far more efficient using an automated tech type process. So I think these are some of the things that really started to change the way city infrastructure was being used and planned, and ultimately it was used as a channel to improve livability and the well-being of citizens. In terms of emerging tech, I mean, there's so many different areas of that, and I guess in the built environment, some examples is building information management, so BIM type systems, IoT, as I mentioned before, the rise of data and analytics, which is an area growing tremendously every year. VR and AR, it's ways to look at things in completely new and different ways and immersive experiences. AI and so forth. And a lot of these in the built environment are starting to converge towards digital twins, places where infrastructure can be viewed now, not only in the physical world, but also a virtual world. And that can help tremendously in terms of planning, maintenance and other scheduling of that infrastructure. Some other areas which are really growing in terms of the technology and the emerging tech, if we look at into urban mobility, so it's now very common that the way transportation systems are being used and planned on a real-time basis, collecting data through various forms of sensors, control centers to help monitor traffic flows and movement of that traffic and better plan the traffic ultimately, reduce congestion and so forth. If you looked at healthcare, telemedicine and these other areas in housing estates, using information to make citizens more aware of what's happening. So all of these different factors are really driving the rise of a smart city.
Thanks for sharing that, Paul. So you've mentioned a bit about how technology is really allowing us to optimize the management of cities to make them a lot more livable. Let's zoom in to one particular aspect of cities, their sustainability footprint. Now, most cities have historically had a major impact on resource consumption and pollution. They attract a sizable population. They concentrate industrial activities. So perhaps I'll pose this to Paul Lam from the AIIB. So Paul, I'm quite interested to get your views on drawing explicit linkages and benefits for digital developments in cities to more sustainable outcomes. How do you think smart city technology could reduce the negative impacts on our environment, or perhaps even lead to improved outcomes to make cities drivers of sustainable development instead?
Thank you very much. I think it really comes back to the fundamental of climate change and sustainability. These are all fundamental consequences of human activities. And it's just like we breathe in and breathe out, that through that process, we create carbon dioxide. And there are two ways that you can really treat it. You can treat it as a demand side problem. Then you can solve it with more optimization of human behavior and changing patterns. That's one side of how smart cities can actually contribute by changing the ways that we live, optimizing it, reducing the demand which creates carbon dioxide and any type of greenhouse gases. Or you can actually solve it with a supply side solutions, which fundamentally is about changing the technologies that we use in the built environment for, you know, just creating less pollutions in the process of supporting the same level of human activities. Trying to make a connection between technology or digital transformation, more particularly with sustainability, I think probably I can share 3 points here. The first one, at the most basic level, there are actual benefits of it. In a city context, take intelligent garbage solutions, which it's really happening right now, that optimizes waste management. That until today, landfill could really cost us more than $300 billion by 2025, according to the World Bank. And just by using smart garbage bin powered by solar, which can communicate with the workers, can reduce the frequency of collections by 70 to 80%. And imagine how much greenhouse gas that you can avoid by having those heavy loaded trucks going around in the city area. And also the smart garbage bin can also be tagged in the future that facilitates the whole recycling processes. There are also efficiency improvements that you can implement with a smart demand response system that could be equivalent to almost an extra 200 gigawatts of generation capacity by 2040. So these are all actual benefits. The second point I want to make is you mentioned a very interesting point that previously innovation and technologies are the culprit of greenhouse gas emissions and climate change. Obviously, the first industrial and the second industrial revolutions have led to it. And I just want to point out that this time is quite different. Instead of creating more stuff or allowing the manufacturing processes to be more streamlined so that we can create even more, this time the technology and the digital transformation is really about how do we get more from less. And fundamentally, for the first time, we do have a digital or technology-driven revolutions which are more aligned with sustainability than the time before. You couldn't imagine the manufacturing processes created by Ford or back then after the Second World War can actually reduce greenhouse gases. But this time is quite different. We have a very good alignment here. The final point that I want to make is technology innovation today also has a third dimension, which is very similar to the cultural aspect as sustainability. If you look at the millennials, if you look at the successful chief officers from the Fortune 500 companies, both technology and sustainability requires executives and consumers to think long-term and to have a vision. And that really, really helps to push some of the transformative changes that require either higher management awareness or higher management commitments. And on the consumer side, it really requires the consumers to think beyond the instantaneous gratification. So when they buy a cup of coffee, they not only care about what that coffee that they consume at the moment, but they were also thinking about the sustainability impact in the future. So that is the most subtle connection, in my view, that sustainability and technology transformation has in this particular time, which I'm pretty excited and quite optimistic about the synergies that technology, not only being able to improve sustainability, but actually there is a very good virtuous cycle between the two.
Thanks for sharing about how the technology-driven fourth industrial revolution is fundamentally different in many respects from its predecessors. Now, I think both of you have mentioned a bit about the subtle aspects of how smart cities are changing demand-driven behaviors. So let's move away from the physical aspects of smart cities to focus a bit more on the intangible aspects. So how are smart cities likewise affecting the nature of urban governance, of public service delivery, and the nature of government citizen accountability? So perhaps I'll ask Paul Kent this. In your work on smart city development in several jurisdictions, have you seen any interesting transformations in public service delivery and the way citizens engage with their local governments in smart cities or even at higher levels?
Yeah, I think there's lots of examples of that happening, and probably some of the easiest and ways is just the use of social media as one example of that. So you can see now lots of discussion by the public on aspects that the government is doing. It can be simple things that, you know, there was rubbish left on a pavement or a parking spot. People are unhappy about that, and that can be posted on social media. So there's now a lot more of these two-way channels that the both the public can raise issues, and similarly the government can be aware of issues. A lot of that is also being more formally adopted on infrastructure development. So it's quite common now to see major infrastructure projects having some type of digital element to it to allow the community to feed back. So again, examples of that could be around wastewater treatment or drainage services, and there will be various apps or online portals where the community can raise back to the government or to the utility owner that there is some problem or a blockage or these sorts of things. So the use of social media or the use of digital for engagement is definitely changing the way, or levels of awareness, and the way both interact with each other. There's lots of examples. And another one perhaps is the way government uses platforms now as a way of soliciting ideas from both businesses and the community. So there's a number of cities in the region where the government has a portal. Businesses can then raise issues or challenges which are facing them. And then this becomes a place where they can interact with each other and try to identify solutions. Similarly, if you look at the way government is moving to varying degrees across ASEAN, and then if you expand that further out into the European nations and the Western, more developed countries. But here in Asia, there's certain cities such as Singapore, which is really moving forward with digital identities, one-stop shops where the citizen can log in, access all the information that they need, all of their records, health, whatever it might be. And it's just a central point where they can interact with the government. So definitely that these sorts of elements are changing the way, the responsiveness, the levels of awareness. And I think that also is driving a lot around accountability as well, because there's just a lot more visibility now on the way and things are being done, the perception of that by the community, the feedback, and social media these days, it can expand very, very fast, not even just in your own community. It can go nationally and it can go internationally as well. So I think that is driving a lot of change.
Thanks, Paul. So thus far, we have outlined what new technologies there are available to transform the way we interact with infrastructure and the built environment and their benefits. So perhaps now let's turn to the corollary question. How do we actually go about financing the rollout of new digital infrastructures or retrofitting old infrastructures in cities? infrastructure financing gaps in developing countries, they're often quite acute, even in conventional infrastructure areas such as toll roads, bridges, etc. So perhaps I'll pose this to Paul from the AIIB. From your experience in the organization, what's your sort of sensation on how cities in developing countries can actually overcome these gaps for investment in digital infrastructure in order to really pivot to becoming a smart city in the future?
On the infrastructure financing gap, that sort of require some basic understanding where these gaps come from. First of all, many of these infrastructure are not bankable, and that creates sort of the gap. Now, the fundamental question that we need to ask is, are these gaps rational, or are these gaps meant to be filled? If a project is not bankable, wouldn't it be better to leave it as a gap rather than trying to force the infrastructure through, which it's just a matter of time that it will show up in your sovereign or your private sector balance sheet that bite. Now, if that's sort of the logic, the perspective that we're looking at the infrastructure financing gap, then smart cities actually provide a very interesting narrative. Traditionally, when we look at the infrastructure financing gap, we're thinking more about private capital mobilization, trying to get more money to plug the gap. But if we start to turn to smart cities, then we really start to open ourselves up for some supply side solution. The gap is actually the demand minus the cost, or I would say the financing need for it. So if we could use smart technologies in the built environment to effectively reduce the costs, or actually using smart technologies to make the design process of infrastructure, the cycle of the infrastructure much shorter, then it really effectively lowers the costs of infrastructure and hence reducing the infrastructure financing gap, not because you need less, but you need less to build the same amount of infrastructure that is required to support the economic development. So if you take that logic, then infrastructure financing gap is not a problem to smart cities. In fact, the other way around, smart infrastructure and smart city is the solution to solve the infrastructure financing gap. Now, what would the countries need to do? From our experience, this is not going to be easy. And there are really two perspectives for it. I'll just try to keep it short and maybe just to focus on key points. The first one is infrastructure assets have been a very sticky and status quo sector. From its construction to its operation to its maintenance and including financing, we have been very path dependent. It was done the same way as yesterday, and yesterday was exactly the same way as the day before. And the reason for that is infrastructure procurement and the whole value chain, it's very sticky. On the construction side, you have all sorts of subcontracting and you have all sorts of procurements that drive for a lower cost base type of construction. And on the financing side, you have very sticky project financiers who look for very passive, steady, long-term cash flows. Now, as we move into the smart infrastructure, the fundamental perspective is that it needs to create economic value, which means it's a good pizza. Now, once you have fulfilled that basic requirement, the real challenge is how should we split it? How should we cut it? Unlike a well-rounded pizza, the smart infrastructure could come in any shapes. It's a better pizza. It costs less to build, but it may be very foreign to traditional infrastructure financiers, because now when you have a smart infrastructure, your cash flows or your benefits may not come from a very steady concessional agreement. It may actually come from sources that a traditional infrastructure investors will never look at, right? Generating advertising revenue sources from some of the smart infrastructure projects or city urban infrastructure. And you are really pushing the whole asset class to think a little bit more about value creation and growth, which is something that infrastructure investors don't necessarily look at. All they wanted is very steady 15, 20 years bridge and road that just stay there and backstopped by government concessional contracts. So that type of change requires a very flexible and collaboration between the private sector and the public sector, and the investors in the infrastructure asset class has to start to think about these things. That is very much a mindset change. The second thing is, on the public side, most of the infrastructure projects, or, you know, city municipal projects, are quite risk averse. And there is a procurement design which comes with it, that it itself may not be very conducive for any type of innovations. And hence, there needs to be a very proper procurement design that fits the new nature of smart cities or design, which instead of focusing on only cost, there needs to be an awareness that an infrastructure is just a means to an end. The focus should be on the outcomes and the users. So it's not about a bridge anymore. It's not about a road anymore. It's about the mobility between point A and point B. Now, if the traditional infrastructure procurement design continues, and the way that we look at a bridge is a capital project, then smart infrastructure becomes very difficult, because the only way that you could justify the extra cost is not by saving cost, is by the extra value add that you generate. Because if you look at the bridge and the road in a traditional way as a capital project, then very soon you will shoot your feet, because every smart infrastructure project may actually come with a higher endowment, a higher bill in the beginning. So the procurement design really needs to figure out a way to mitigate this. And I personally find it quite optimistic, because better information, better availability of the demand forecast will all help it. And finally, the last point that I would like to mention is, although this is not totally about financing, but this is more about the whole ecosystem, smart cities is not a thing itself. It's a result that, and many times we have forgotten its purpose. When it comes to smart city, in the end, it's all about the outcomes and the users. And we have to be very, very disciplined to listening to what the citizens need. And it's not just for the sake of having a city smart, but smart for what? And that is very important. And only by being able to define these values very concretely and being able to communicate these benefits, that will help the financiers to be clearer on what they are actually financing. And only by measuring and being very disciplinary on the values that you have created, that you have a hope to try to structure it, converting some of the economic values into some financial benefits to crowd in capital. So I think that's very, very important. And I think from a financier's perspective, the reasons why smart city hasn't really been the top agenda for many sponsors is that the values are still a bit vague, except in a few cases where very concretely cost is being saved, new revenue streams can be created. But I think there needs to be more thinking on it.
Thanks for sharing that, Paul. You've made quite a lot of interesting points. I think for me, one of them which stands out is perhaps the need for infrastructure financiers to really wrap their heads around the benefit, the additional benefits of having data as an intangible asset from smart infrastructure and smart cities. So this perhaps leads me to my final theme about the nature of data governance and data management in a smart city ecosystem. So, for instance, if we're looking at the current context in many countries, the entire debate about contact tracing and data privacy is emerging in the context of the COVID-19 pandemic in many countries and many cities. This is perhaps a case in point about how people expect data to be managed in a transparent and secure process. So perhaps for my final question, I'd perhaps like to get both of your brief perspectives on how smart cities could manage this issue effectively. Perhaps let's turn Paul from KPMG first to get his own view on this.
Yeah, thanks, Brandon. So data privacy is a massive topic. So as data grows and personal data grows, then the obligation to securely store that data and use it appropriately is ever more important. Within cities, so there's so many different areas where data can be collected about an individual. And I guess that's one of the challenges. There's few cities that have, a comprehensive, encompassing system that manages all these different areas. And more likely, it would be parts of a city that are managing the data in a single place. So to give some examples of that, even if you deal with the government and you've got your healthcare records, your payments, your superannuation payments, your wages and all these different parts, driver's license, passports, your movements, these will all be collected by different agencies. And so how that data is being stored usually will be at some different location depending on the department or the agency which is responsible for it. And then how that's being managed within those particular areas, it's up to, I guess, that capacity and capability of the respective departments. You expand that out beyond into the private sector and the businesses that individuals are interacting with. Again, there is personal data being collected at those points. So, the banks will be collecting data, airline companies will be collecting data on people and where they're traveling to and so on. So in some ways, this question actually always arises, and it's around the collection of data. Is it intruding into private lives and these sorts of aspects? And I would say here that it may not be quite as quick, but a person's data is already out there and available for people to access it. So if you're surfing the internet, you can see habits of what people are up to there if they wanted to. If you were through your telephone records and where you're traveling to, if people want to use it, they can track you through that and so on. But that said, there is an obligation that governments that are collecting data and businesses which are collecting data do have an obligation to make sure that that data is stored confidentially and appropriately. So then we get into all these other parts of data governance, the way data is being stored, how's it being used, how's it being classified, who has access to it. You get into issues around cybersecurity, and interestingly, when there is breaches of personal data, sometimes it can be a pure technology-related cybersecurity breach. But often it can also just be a breakdown in process where the procedures and the process around capturing and the use of that data can be manipulated by someone, even not through a technology means, but just people can access that data and use it for inappropriate means. Now, coming back, I guess, to the COVID situation, personally, that it does make a difference, and it's a good thing to do. There is an obligation, definitely, that data must be stored and collected and used appropriately by the agencies that are using it for the purpose of tracing where people are moving. So I do know that in some countries there's this concern that, people will be able to track where I'm going and all these things. Actually, they can already do that. So I sort of feel that argument's perhaps missing the point that they can still do that if someone wants to. Now, some other things just on that whole area of data and data governance, data management, is there's a balance between how data is regulated. So you have one part around the laws and the regulations around how data is to be used, and there'll be personal data protection commissions and these sorts of organisations in countries that are responsible for that. There's questions around the capacity and capability of those organisations. So if we were to move across the region and even globally, there'll be those that can do this very well in terms of capacity and capabilities, but there'll be others that are really at the starting point of that. And even the laws and regulations may just be starting around how data should be used, regulated, captured, stored, and so forth. And then when you move into the next question about then how is it actually being enforced, it's even it becomes less mature, I would say. So you can have some laws and regulations, and in some countries that's going to be very well developed, like GDPR. You'll go down into other jurisdictions where they might make reference to certain laws and regulations, but they don't really know what it means. And the regulators that are using that sort of law and regulation are lacking in their ability to understand it. And then you moved into the enforcement side of it as well, which has become even more difficult, I think, depending on the capacity and capabilities of an organization. So we've done work on the ASEAN data governance framework, which is across all 10 ASEAN member states. And this is some of the challenges that are being faced in that sort of context. And the last thing I'd sort of mention as well is that there is a balance between regulation of data or data regulations and innovation. And at the moment, I think one of the struggles which is happening is that technology is evolving so fast. The data which is being collected is growing exponentially. Data technologies or technologies in general are growing maybe daily, right? And regulation takes years to implement, and to change regulation is not something that can be done even on a monthly basis. It needs to go through a process. So the ability of regulation to keep pace with innovation and technology is a challenge. And similarly, over-regulating something then starts to put the constraints on innovation and the use of technology. So there's this very fine balance between the two, and then the costs that are incurred by businesses and people and so forth to comply with that. So back to you, Brandon, just some thoughts, and perhaps over to Paul.
Thanks. Yes, I think I'd love to hear Paul from the AIB. I'd love to hear your insights, some of your brief insights on these issues as well.
Thank you very much. First of all, let me just agree with everything that Paul Kent from KPMG says. I think that's absolutely true. Challenges rely in the implementation and how do you actually carry this out. We could have endless philosophical debates on this topic. So maybe there are probably 2 to 3 points that I will add. The first one is, I think it's impossible for us to talk about data management and data governance or data privacies unless we start to go one level up. What is data, and what is the difference of the data that has been collected and generated in a potential smart city context? The data that you are collecting, only by understanding the differences and only by understanding the context, would allow us to address the concerns either from community, from politicians, or from any other stakeholders. I think one of the common trends that I have seen is we are very, very impatient, and we try to draw a lot of similarities and the lessons learned from how do we protect data in other places, like, let's say, Facebook or WeChat or any other social media platforms. And the GDPR, for example, has taken a lot of lessons that we have learned over the last 5 to 10 years on payments, on social media, and on many other things. Now, in the smart city context, it's really important for us to understand how the data is collected and being used can be quite fundamentally different, right? To give you one example, my footprint in a city context versus my footprint in social media are two different things. Now, this is for the first time that we are looking at an integration of human and computer online and offline. So on Facebook or on any other internet platforms, we're mainly talking about online to online service delivery. So the whole footprint can be quite digital. Now, when it comes to actual transport in Uber, you start to have actual security needs. Let's say, what if a driver has a bad intention? To what extent can we actually trace the footprint of the passengers to protect him or to protect her? It's very hard for me to imagine on Facebook somebody messaging me or others could actually violently impact my safety. So there are a lot more concerns. So I think in order for us to have a useful and open dialogue, the first step we really need to take is to think about the differences of the data that we're collecting and as well as the context. The second point that I would like to add is when it comes to cities, we have to really bear in mind, again, there is a very special element about a city. There's a cultural aspect of it. Again, when you go to a city, we all enjoy tourism. We all enjoy going to a new cities. We go to a new cities not necessarily because we can live a better life there or we can do certain things. Probably most of the cities provide very, very similar experience from a materialistic perspective. But we enjoy going to different cities because there's a different culture. Now, in some places, we love to go to Asian countries or we love to go to African countries or Latin American. We see a completely different ways that community communicates. People are more friendly. People are doing different things. And that is very important. And the reasons why I want to use that example is when you're talking about data, if we all believe that data is owned by ourselves, then we need to take into account what the people wants. If there is no universal rules on how a city should be built or how culture should be built, then the uses of data may actually be quite versatile, and we have to be quite mindful and be very sensitive to the cultural differences between different regions. And I think I totally agree with Paul Kantz that technology is growing so fast and regulations take decades to actually materialize. And in a smart city context, it probably will take even longer because Rome is not built in one day. And I think cities are almost a very, very complicated ecosystem that is not just a technology problem, that we could easily think about regulatory framework as if we're managing an online social media platform. But in a city context, there's so many more perspectives that we need to take into account. The cultural perspective, the safety perspective, the differences of activities that we're engaging in, the integration of online and offline, digital and physical. These are all things that I can be quite confident to say over the last 10 to 20 years in the internet economy boom that we haven't really tackled these questions. And so I would say I'm cautiously optimistic. And I think it's important that we do not make very hasty conclusions. And at this point, it's about understanding, having dialogues, and really, really putting the community and the citizens' thoughts and needs in the top priority. Only by having a dialogue, it's not about getting to the results, but the process that we engage, the process that we discuss will be instrumental to the success itself. Because the answers are not going to be trivial. And the more engaging and the more inclusive we are in the process will probably allow us to get to where we want to go more effectively.
Thanks for sharing that, Paul. I think both of you have given us very interesting points to contemplate about smart cities. So on a final note, thank you both for joining us today. It's been a real pleasure to talk to you both about how technology intersects with urbanization and how our cities are becoming much smarter and sustainable. To listen to more of OMFIF podcasts, please check us out on the OMFIF channel on both Spotify and iTunes. And if you've enjoyed listening, please subscribe to our channel. If you've appreciated this podcast, then please do leave us a review. Thank you very much.